If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is not the sound of a stream running through the mountains. It's water from a leaking pipe trickling down a stairway. That's not a frog splashing into a lake. It's a piece of sheetrock falling into a puddle on a kitchen floor. And that's not a hiker taking a deep breath of mountain air. It's a homeowner gasping at the sight of a $12,000 water damage repair bill. 40% of homeowners have experienced water damage. Protect your home with the Moen Smart Water Monitor and Shutoff. Moen.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Elevate every morning with Tommy John's Second Skin Underwear. The luxurious support of Second Skin guarantees everything will go smoothly. With over 20 million pairs sold and thousands of five-star reviews, guys love Tommy John. Plus, your most valuable assets are covered with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear or its free guarantee. Shop Tommy John's Friends and Family Sale right now and get 25% off site-wide at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. TommyJohn.com/Spotify. See site for details.
People, mainly nuns apparently, took fleas, dead fleas, and then made little costumes for them and put them in the costumes and created little tiny tableaux.
That was Stephen Moss on some remarkable animals from history.
I would love to have a word with Elizabeth I and work out how she sorted on the colours in her wardrobe, because really, even today, any redhead wanting to know what colours are going to work for them need look no further than a portrait of Elizabeth I.
And that was Jackie Collis-Harvey talking to us about red hair through the ages. You're listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available from all good newsagents or via subscription. Check out our latest subscription deals at historyextra.com/subscribe. The magazine is also now available on many digital devices, including the iPad, iPhone, Kindle, Kindle Fire, Google Play, Kobo and Zinio. Look out for us in your App Store or newsstand, or find out more at historyextra.com/digital. Welcome to our second podcast of December 2015. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History Magazine. Our first interview this week is with Stephen Moss, a writer and producer. Stephen is a co-author of Natural Histories, a book that explains how 25 extraordinary species have changed our world. The book accompanies a BBC Radio 4 series of the same name, presented by Stephen's co-author, Brett Westwood. Our deputy editor, Charlotte Hodgman, caught up with Stephen recently to find out more.
Stephen, just firstly, perhaps tell us a little bit about the book and, you know, what inspired you and Brett to write the book?
Well, I think Brett and I have always been very, very interested in the cultural history of nature. It's something we wrote about, touched on in Tweet of the Day, and I've written about it in the past. And when the radio series Natural Histories came up, which Brett presents, I think we both thought, what a lovely opportunity for a book. And luckily, the publisher of Tweet of the Day agreed.
And so the stories themselves, you know, have you just been doing lots of research and you've picked the best? Or, you know, are these things that you knew about before you started writing?
In some cases, yes, I did know about them. I mean, what happened was that we had 25 groups or species picked by the radio team. So I didn't have any say in that at all. I was actually quite intrigued when they gave me the list, because it had very obvious things on, like lion and shark and whale. And then it had groups like monkeys and apes and parrots. And then it had really obscure things, sea anemones, meteorites, which obviously aren't obscure in themselves, but aren't particularly natural, but have an interesting story to tell. And my favourite, the burbot, which we thought was a misprint for turbot, isn't.
Yes, I mean, I was going to say there's a very wide range of topics covered, you know, from fleas to corals to, you know, to nightshades to eggs, you know, you name it, it's in there. So perhaps, you know, perhaps we can sort of just touch on some of the stories that you cover. One that kind of caught my eye were the dressed up fleas.
Yes.
Which I think is definitely something that should be brought back.
Yes,
Tell me a little bit about that. What is this?
Well, it's a very bizarre story. I mean, fleas have quite a strong cultural history, because, of course, they don't just live alongside us like the other animals in the book. They live on us. And so they really have, they probably go back to right the very beginning of our history as the human race. We had fleas with us. The dressed fleas are a very strange phenomenon from, I think, the late 19th, early 20th century in Mexico, where people, mainly nuns apparently, took fleas, dead fleas, and then made little costumes for them and put them in the costumes and created little tiny tableaux. You can imagine about 2 or 3 millimetres high, of things like a wedding party. So it's utterly bizarre, because you can imagine doing that with, say, beetles, because beetles come in lots of different shapes and sizes, and some of them you could imagine, you know, have the sort of head and body. But a flea is so tiny that it just seems completely bizarre. It did die out, not entirely unexpectedly. But someone, I think, might be even trying to resurrect it. I think we mentioned someone in the book who's trying to do that.
Oh, I mean, do we know why? You know, how is the flea seen? Why was it sort of celebrated like this?
Well, I looked quite heavily into this and I couldn't find an answer. There wasn't an obvious reason why. I think it was just something that started and became a bit of a cult. With other creatures, you know, you understand why. So the hornbill is a wonderful story, this fantastic bird that lives in tropical Asia and Africa. And one particular hornbill, the helmeted hornbill, has a very hard, they all have this strange, what they call a cask above their bill, which is a piece of, well, they actually call it hornbill ivory. And it's rather like that, it's keratin. So it's like what our hair and is made out of. And what they do with the helmeted hornbill, because its cask is, the front of it is solid, they would carve them, the Chinese and the Malays, into immensely ornate shapes and beautiful carvings known as netsuke. I suppose about 500-600 years ago, this was the height of this, which are now very valuable. So that was a wonderful story. Because, of course, all these stories, including the dressed fleas, are based on an object in the Natural History Museum. And that's something that was really the starting point for each story.
So going back to the fleas, have fleas always been seen as the sort of pests that they are today, or have they sort of represented something else through history?
No, I think they've always been seen as pests. No, I don't think people like fleas at all. I mean, the exception, of course, was the great Charles Rothschild, who founded the museum, basically founded the Wildlife Trusts movement, but also founded the big museum in Tring that was a private museum and then was transferred to the British Museum after his death. And his daughter, Miriam Rothschild, who was a wonderful character, only died a few years ago in her 90s. And Dame Miriam Rothschild was obsessed with fleas and wrote wonderful books about them and made them as exciting as any animal you can imagine. So she features in the book, of course. We've got some great people in the book as well.
Okay, and then another one that caught my eye was crocodiles and how they've sort of been revered, particularly by the ancient Egyptians. Why the crocodile?
I think it's more, you know, in a way, it's more understandable why the crocodile should be revered, because it's an extraordinarily fierce, well-adapted animal that's very good at what it it does, and it's very obvious if you go into Africa or Australia, you see them, and you know, and they are extraordinarily charismatic animals. So yes, the Egyptians actually had a city named after them. It's nicknamed after them, actually. It's called Crocodilopolis.
Yeah, I was trying to say that earlier.
Easy for me to say. I had to practice that one. But they're not the only people. The people of East Timor, in I think the Western Pacific, forgive my geography here, their island, the island of Timor itself, is shaped a little bit like a crocodile. And so they worship crocodiles. But that had a rather downside, that they, because they worshipped them, they thought they were harmless and apparently used to get killed quite frequently by them. As do people even today in Australia and Africa. You know, crocodiles are pretty lethal.
And do we know what Crocodilopolis, do we know what, you know, what that place was like? You know, do people go and visit it?
It was a city where they had mummified crocodiles and worshipped them and would bury mummified crocodiles and their eggs in the tombs of important people. You know, so you would find a wrapped crocodile. And I think there was actually a mummified crocodile, may be still there in the Natural History Museum.
So these you mentioned about the museum. So if people visit the museum, are these objects going to be labelled? Will people be able to see them as they walk round?
Yeah, they do an exhibition. They've got a new gallery there where they've put some of their most special exhibits, including, for me, I think my favourite exhibits of this. One is the Barbary lion skull, which was dug up in the Tower of London, which dates right the way back to the 13th century, and is the skull of a now extinct race, North African race of the lion. So that's a wonderful story. And then the other incredible object is one of the few I actually knew about before, which was that it's an emperor penguin's egg, which was brought back by the polar explorer Apsley Cherry Garrard, who was with Scott in the Antarctic, went out on this extraordinary expedition to try to collect emperor penguin's eggs to prove a now sadly discredited theory about evolution, brought them back. And they now rest in the museum. But the story has two follow-ups. One that Cherry Garrard then wrote one of the great classics of travel writing called The Worst Journey in the World, which is an extraordinary tale of hardship and horror undertaken by these men. And then he was also the man who found Robert Falcon Scott, Captain Scott's body, the bodies of the others, in the tent where they had failed to reach safety. So it's a very moving story, and the egg is a wonderful starting point for these stories, as all these objects are in the book. You know, the Natural History Museum is a place I visited when I was a child. It's my favourite place in the world, I think, in terms of places like that. And it's such an inspiring place, and these objects, many of them are now on display there, so you can see the actual things mentioned in the series and the book.
Brilliant. I mean, I was going to ask you actually whether you had any favourites. It sounds like the Barbary lion is one of them. Did you want to maybe tell us a little bit about that?
The Barbary lion was dug up, as I say. It was found, I think, in the 1930s when two workmen were working on the Tower of London and dug up some skulls. And it was, I think it was known then, but not really appreciated, that the Tower of London was home to an extraordinary menagerie of animals. From roughly the reign of King John onwards, so the 12th century onwards. And this menagerie had lions in. There's a terrible story of a young woman visiting, I think in the 18th century, many years later, where she puts her hand rather too near the cage and the lion pulls it in and bites her arm off and she dies of infection. You know, terrible story. But what these lions were, of course, it's what the book is mostly about, if it, you know, and the series as well, is what these animals mean to us. So we talk about the biology of the lion and the biology of the shark and the crocodile and the sea anemone and all these things. But what we are really interested in, and the purpose of the series and the book, is to talk about the cultural history. So why was this lion a symbol, and what was it a symbol of? And lions are inherently a symbol of power, which sort of makes sense until you remember that male lions, which are the symbol, tend to basically lie around not doing very much while the women do all the work. Tigers, for example, would be a much more powerful symbol, if you like, of a lone hunter. But lions, it may be just because by a sort of historical accident that there were more lions in Britain in those days, because Africa, North Africa, had been explored by the Romans, so they had lions. So, you know, lions were part of our culture from a very long time ago, and maybe that's why they became a symbol. So when we started looking at what lions are a symbol of, I'm going to leaf through the book briefly because I need to remember this, but they are, you know, there's a lion bar, isn't there? A chocolate bar. Sky TV, lions. You know, the Sikh surname Singh means lion. Comes from an ancient word meaning lion, and that's one of the commonest surnames in the world. Richard the Lionheart, of course. You know, he wasn't stupid. He was a king whose pretensions to kingship were rather tricky. So he said, right, I'm going to brand myself, if you like. It's one of the earliest examples of branding. Three lions on the England shirt. Famous song. You get lions on school badges. You get them. My old school actually had a lion on. I'd forgotten that. Companies that use lions: Peugeot cars, Lowenbrow beer, which means lion's brew, the Football Premier League, Chelsea, Aston Villa, England, Cunard Cruises, the rock band Queen, Sky Sports, and Metro Goldwyn Mayer. Now, you know, that shows the power of these symbols. The fact that we say, oh, Richard the Lionheart, yes, it's a bit obvious, isn't it, using a lion as his symbol? Well, we still do it. We just don't even notice.
So where's the line then in history between, you know, these animals that are seen as very powerful, and then you've got the kind of the sort of more monstrous side of things, haven't you? Things like you mentioned the squid, the giant squid in your book.
Yes.
Why was that not seen in the same way?
Well, they're seen, the giant squid is seen as a fearsome sea monster because it was so mysterious. No one knew what it really was. No one caught one until quite recently. You know, these are a truly mysterious animal. The other one that's interesting, though, is the shark, because the lion and the shark are both top predators. They're both feared, but the lion is admired and the shark is hated. And several people we interviewed, viewed some excellent academics and social historians and other people in the series, and they're represented in the book as well. And, you know, some of them were saying, well, the thing about the shark is when it looks at you, it shows no emotion, no expression. Now, that's not the shark's fault. That's just the nature of sharks. But this has led, and of course, I'm going to do something now and you will know immediately what I'm doing, even with my terrible singing voice. Da-da, da-da. Da, 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 da. You know what that is,
Who could forget?
Now, that's the theme music of Jaws. Wonderful story here. John Williams, young composer. Steven Spielberg, young, newly established film director, but not as famous as, of course, they are now, these multi-Oscar winning men. John Williams goes round to see Spielberg, and Spielberg says, how are you getting on with the idea for the theme for the film Jaws? And Williams says, well, I've got it. And he plays two notes on the piano. And then he steps back. And Spielberg says, are you having a laugh? Or words to that effect. And he says, no, that's the theme. It's just two notes. And, you know, that film in itself, and Peter Benchley, who wrote the book for Jaws, later came to regret this and ended up working to save sharks. It ended, you know, that film caused many, many millions of people around the world to have an entirely irrational, really, fear of sharks. Because, you, as we say, your chances, you're more likely to be struck by lightning on the way to the beach than you are to be killed by a shark. But nevertheless, people still fear it.
Thanks for those two notes, really.
Yeah. And the fact the shark, you know, there's something horrible about sharks that we can't get out of our head. And I think it's this merciless killer idea, that we don't think of lions and tigers as merciless killers.
No, they seem to be... Sharks sort of come across as a bit cold, you know.
Yeah.
Cold fish.
Yeah. Yeah. And yet, you know, of course, the shark is rarer than the great white shark is rarer than the tiger. You know, these are terribly endangered animals because we kill 70 million sharks a year, which is an awful lot more than sharks kill people.
Mm, yeah. So going back to the small again.
Yes.
Cockroaches I've always found them quite intriguing, and there's so many myths, aren't there, around the cockroaches. Can they survive a nuclear war? You know, all sorts of different things. Why do they generate so much sort of almost fascination?
Well, they're another one that generates loathing. Recently, a commentator who I won't deign to name compared the people trying to cross the Mediterranean, the asylum seekers, to cockroaches. And of course, she knew exactly what she was doing, because this is something that's been done twice before in history. Hitler compared the Jews to cockroaches, and the Hutu people in Rwanda compared the Tutsis to cockroaches. And it dehumanizes people when you call them cockroaches. It immediately, it's so repulsive. And the famous Franz Kafka novella, Metamorphosis, we always think it's a cockroach. He never says. The man wakes up as an insect. It could be any insect, but for us, it's always a cockroach. And if you Google Kafka cockroach, you will get lots of references. So that shows just the power of this animal, and partly it's because they are fairly indestructible. And again, rather like fleas, because they live alongside us. So we encounter them, and we don't like it when other animals invade our space.
I mean, what other animals would you say stood out for you, you know, during your research for the book?
I think my favourite was the burbot, actually.
Oh, yes, yes. Tell us about the burbot.
It's a fish. It's a cold water, freshwater member of the cod family, the only freshwater member of the cod family. It is almost certainly extinct in Britain, but there have been two intriguing recent sightings, which we mentioned, one of which was by a French angler who knows burbot very well because they're quite common in France, and he's convinced one swam up. And he looked at it and it swam away. It was only later he discovered that they're not found in Britain. They used to be. So that's an intriguing story. Chekhov wrote a short story about the burbot. It was apparently very beautiful to eat. And my favourite thing is there is a Swedish death metal band. It's a genre of heavy metal with which I'm not overly familiar. And they sing a song about the burbot, the burbot's revenge. So it has a strange cultural history. And that was an inspired choice by the producer, Mary Colwell, of the radio series, who said, right, we've got to do this because it's such a great story.
And why do you think meteors and coral and things like that, why do you think they've been picked out for the book?
Well, coral, of course, is an animal, which many people don't appreciate. They either think it's a rock formation or a plant or some combination of the two, and they are animals, and they're intriguing animals. That was very much about the image of paradise, the Coral Island by R.M. Ballantyne, which was a novel that even by my childhood in the 60s we didn't really read anymore, but it was immensely popular in the Victorian era, and it's about boys stranded on a coral island. The flip side of that was when William Golding wrote Lord of the Flies, which was effectively, he deliberately conceived it as an antidote to the sort of Victorian heroics of Coral Island. And Robinson Crusoe is a desert island, but I think we have this image of coral atolls as being, you know, paradise. And of course, corals are being destroyed, coral atolls are being destroyed all around the world. They have been for many years, and they still are being, by devastation, by overfishing, by things like climate change, you know, lots of things are affecting them. So it's a sort of trouble in paradise story. Every program and every chapter in the book has an angle on the natural world. They don't just repeat each other. They're very much looking at different aspects. The meteorites is about life outside our knowledge. And I was reading even this morning in the paper, there's a new theory that the reason the dinosaurs, who were also in the book, died out so quickly when the meteorite hit the Earth 66 million years ago, is that it sparked off, the impact sparked off explosions from lots of volcanoes, which then basically lowered, you know, filled the air with smoke, lowered the temperature, plants died, animals died, there was nothing for the dinosaurs to eat, and they disappeared in an extraordinarily short time.
I mean, perhaps we should finish up with the dinosaurs. What do you say about those in the book?
Well, one of the most intriguing things about dinosaurs, which is being discovered in the last few years, is that they had feathers. They mostly had feathers. They didn't all have feathers. The large ones had probably lost them. But some of the smaller ones had feathers. They were not cold-blooded, as we think, nor were they exactly warm-blooded. They're sort of mesothermic. It's a concept, funny enough, sharks are the same, where they could control their body temperature up to a point. And so they were much more active than we used to think. They weren't these great lumbering beasts. And the lovely thing about dinosaurs, of course, particularly for me as a obsessive ornithologist, is that they are still with us. Birds are dinosaurs. They descended from the same common ancestor. Birds are actually more closely related to dinosaurs than other reptiles are. So
you can sort of see that, can't you, when the way they move sometimes.
So yeah, you can see it. And there's a wonderful scene which I mentioned in the book at the end of Jurassic Park, the film, wonderful film, where Jeff Goldblum is flying away, having escaped the carnage, and they look down and there is a flock of brown pelicans, which are probably the most dinosaur-like bird in the world, flying back towards the island. And he says something like, oh, they're still with us, you know, and it's a wonderful moment. And that's a relatively recent discovery. 30, 40 years ago, people had a very different image of dinosaurs from what we have now.
Are there any animals that didn't make the book that you would love to have seen in print?
Yeah, I think there were, I mean, obviously I love birds. We have parrots, hornbills and birds' eggs. I'd have loved to have cranes. Cranes are magnificent birds, worshipped around the world. I think they would have made a very good story. But there may be a second series. You never know. If there's a second series of the radio series, you know, they had a list as long as your arm of things they could have put in. And as I say, I think Mary and Julian Hector and the production team and Brett, of course, who presents it, did a fantastic job finding these stories, really making sure that they had the right combination of stories. And I think they are a truly wonderful combination of really stories that some of the readers will know quite well. Most people know quite a lot about Jaws, for example, but hopefully they won't know perhaps about other aspects of that chapter and other animals in the book.
That was Stephen Moss. Natural Histories, 25 Extraordinary Species That Have Changed Our World, is out now, published by John Murray. And you can listen to 25 episodes of the BBC Radio 4 Natural Histories series on the BBC iPlayer Radio. Meanwhile, why not check out the Christmas edition of BBC History magazine, which is currently on sale. In this month's issue, we have articles on Victorian poverty, Elizabeth I's rivalry with Mary, Queen of Scots, the medieval history behind Game of Thrones, and the Battle of the Atlantic, among other things. You can get hold of our Christmas edition in all good newsagents and in our many digital formats.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Elevate every morning with Tommy John's Second Skin Underwear. The luxurious support of Second Skin guarantees everything will go smoothly. With over 20 million pairs sold and thousands of five-star reviews, guys love Tommy John. Plus, your most valuable assets are covered with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear or its free guarantee. Shop Tommy John's Friends and Family Sale right now and get 25% off site-wide at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. TommyJohn.com/Spotify. See site for details.
Spring is a time of renewal, so why not refresh your home with a little help from Blinds.com? Blinds.com invented a better way to shop for custom window treatments. There's no pushy salespeople in your home or inflated showroom prices. Free samples, free shipping, and our 100% satisfaction guarantee can put the spring back into your step and into your home, too. Shop Blinds.com now and save up to 45%. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Before our next interview, here's a reminder about our BBC History magazine events, which are taking place next February. On Saturday the 27th and Sunday the 28th of that month, at Bristol's Emshed Museum, we're holding two-day events themed around Roman Britain and the First World War in 1916, respectively. Each day includes a star-studded lineup of speakers, plus a buffet lunch. To find out more or purchase tickets, please visit historyextra.com/events. Our second interview this week is with Jackie Collis Harvey. Jackie is the author of Red, which tells the story of red hair through the ages, from its prehistoric origins through the ancient world to Elizabeth I and beyond. She spoke to our reviews editor, Matt Elton, who began by asking Jackie where the inspiration for the book came from.
I work in publishing, and I was sitting in a sales conference watching another publisher present their series of history titles, and I was amusing myself by coming up with potential new ideas for them. And I had this real red light bulb overhead moment. And I came back and I'd filled 3 notebooks in a month. When you have red hair, people share with you their theories, their thoughts, their feelings about red hair all your life. So I had quite a lot of material to work with. But I began to realize that there was a real historical detective story to uncover here. And the further I went into it, the more fascinating it became.
I mean, heading back to the very earliest days that we possibly can, how far can we trace the genetic origins?
A long, long way back. We can trace it back 50,000 years. That's when the gene first appeared on the planet.
And so whereabouts did that happen?
It was in the grasslands of Central Asia, astonishingly enough. Nothing to do with Scotland or Ireland at all. But 50,000 years ago, the early modern humans who became all of us had got that far and no further. And since geneticists can be confident that's when the gene appeared, that's where we were at the time.
Do we get a sense of how red hair was regarded in the ancient world?
We do. It crops up in the writings of a lot of classical authors. There's a very famous quote from Xenophanes on how men make gods in their own image. Therefore, the gods of the Thracians have blue eyes and red hair. And Herodotus, for whom the Thracians were near neighbours, also discusses the fact that red hair was very, very common amongst the Thracian tribes. And he also characterises them as being the epitome of everything that was barbaric at the time. So that's one big stereotype of red-headed men, certainly, comes into being thousands of years ago.
Do we get an idea of why it was regarded in such extreme ways, even then, thousands of years ago?
I think it's because it has always been rare, so it has always been other. And for most of our time on this planet, it seems that anything that is other has been regarded with suspicion and with a measure of fear as well. But undoubtedly, the tribes who lived in Thrace, which is now pretty much modern Bulgaria and a little bit of Greece around the Black Sea, did have a very, very different lifestyle to the classical authors who were encountering them and commenting upon them. They lived in small tribal units, for example, which might account for the preponderance of red hair amongst them. And they refused to move into cities. They spurned every form of earning a living other than fighting, either between themselves or for other people. They provided a lot of mercenaries for Alexander the Great, for example. And absolutely shockingly, as far as the classical authors were concerned, Herodotus in particular, they were very free and easy in the way they regarded the women in their societies, who were no watch was kept on them, is what Herodotus says. They were allowed to have relationships willy-nilly with who they pleased until they decided they were going to get married.
So their red hair became a marker of their otherness, in a sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. A period in which they did become, people with red hair did become particularly discriminated against was the medieval period, wasn't it?
Yes. But again, one of the things that makes red hair so fascinating is the fact that it is so gendered. And once again, it was bad for men and good for women. The medieval artists depict red-haired Judas over and over again in their scenes of the agony in the garden or of the betrayal. Red hair is it's not common, but it certainly crops up in the Jewish community because the Jewish community is endogamous and doesn't marry out as much as other communities do. And red hair being a recessive gene, those circumstances give it the greatest possible chance of expressing itself. And it seems that when the first Jewish communities moved into Europe, immediately red hair was picked up on as a signifier of their otherness. So you get this image of red-haired Judas cropping up in medieval art. And obviously that did nothing at all for the image of red-headed men. However, at the same time, you also get a red-headed Mary Magdalene as well. And she was one of the most beloved and empowered figures in the whole of the Catholic pantheon. So there's a huge split between male and female representations of red hair from very early on.
How did people square that difference?
Seriously, I have absolutely no idea. I think it meant otherness and untrustworthiness for men, but for women, as it has seems to do for a very, very long time, it seems to have been connected with the fact that Mary Magdalene, as the Western Church constructed her, was regarded as a reformed prostitute, and therefore had something to do with the idea that red hair in women is erotic and sexually interesting and carries with it this overtone of being a slight sexual outlaw in a way, something slightly bohemian.
As we head into the Renaissance, the signifiers changed, didn't they?
Yes, they did. Yes.
So what happened in that period?
Well, very interestingly, of course, Elizabeth I was a redhead. Henry VIII, her father, was certainly a redhead, and quite clearly Anne Boleyn must have been carrying the gene. And in Elizabethan England, red hair and a pale skin became extraordinarily fashionable, and also was a sign of your loyalty to the Queen. There are any number of redheads in Elizabethan portraiture. They can't all have been natural, and we do know that the Elizabethans used to use tints and dyes to change their hair colour so that they were able to copy this fashionable icon of white skin and red hair that began with Elizabeth I. And in that period, it seems to have become a sort of signifier of Englishness as well. Red and white were very much Elizabeth's brand colours, as it were, but they were also the colours of St. George, who was the only English saint to survive the Reformation. And there is a wonderful poem by Sir John Davis. It must be one of the most toadying pieces of verse ever created in the English language, I think, where he puts together an enormous series of verses, the first letters of the first line of which, for each verse, each line in each verse, spell out the name Elizabeth. But the conceit in the entire poem is how the colours red and white are incomplete until they're given the queenly magnificence that Elizabeth could bring to them.
Wow.
It's a really, it's a sustained piece of flattery that you have to take your hat off to. You really do. And obviously, as an historian of red hair, hugely exciting for me.
Yes. The book touches on a whole range of kind of portraits and other images. Are there any that particularly stand out for you?
Well, I do love the portraits of Elizabeth I. I found the coronation portrait of her particularly interesting because I think it influenced the depiction of Boudica, another warrior queen, in Holinshed's Chronicles, which was published during Elizabeth's reign, where Boudica appears before her troops with long flowing hair, just as in Elizabeth's coronation portrait, and with this little open-arched, notched crown on her head. And the troops she is addressing, of course, the artist makes no attempt at all to depict them in the costume that the Iceni warriors would have worn. Instead, they're armoured as Elizabethan men-at-arms. And you really can't look at that image without thinking also of Elizabeth addressing her troops when the Spanish Armada was threatening England. It's this idea of a warrior queen on an island with red hair, as so many warrior queens are depicted as having even today, and bolstering her troops' courage against this foreign invader. It's very, very powerful, politically very interesting.
And really striking too.
Yeah.
We've touched on Elizabeth, obviously. Are there any other characters that for you really stand out?
I am very fond of my cover girl, Alexa Wilding. She was pursued down the street by the Pre-Raphaelite artist Dante Gabriel Rossetti when she was just 16 years old and had what must have been a very strange conversation with him, this man telling her that he was an artist and that he wanted her to sit for him. Unsurprisingly, she didn't keep their first appointment. She probably thought that she had had a narrow escape from God knows what as a young woman in London in the 1860s. But he then spotted her again from his hansom cab, had his hansom cab pulled to a screeching halt at the curb, one imagines, charged down the street after again. And this time she did agree to sit for him and she became his most used model. In fact, he paid her not to sit for anybody else.
Wow. If you could somehow travel back in time and talk to somebody in this book, what would you ask them, do you think?
Oh, that's such a good question. question. I would love to speak with members of the Jewish community in medieval Europe and see how they felt about this form of stigmatization. I'd love to know how they themselves felt about red hair, because, of course, in the Bible, King David has red hair. So it might have meant one thing to the community around them and something very, very different to them. I would love to have a word with Elizabeth I and work out how she sorted on the colours in her wardrobe, because really, even today, any redhead wanting to know what colours are going to work for them need look no further than a portrait of Elizabeth I. She absolutely had it down.
What was the thing that surprised you the most?
I was astonished to discover that, first of all, red hair is extraordinarily difficult to perm, as I have had many, many disastrous perms in my time on my own hair, and suddenly I understood why. It has much stronger chemical linkages than hair of other colours, which is why it is particularly challenging if you're trying to perm it into curls. And I was one of the redheads who was born without the ringlets that so many redheads get, so hence the disastrous perms in my hair's history. But I was also very interested to discover all of the things that make redheads genetically unique. For example, the fact that we have a much more acid skin mantle than people with hair of other colours, which changes the way that scents and aftershaves work on our skin. I was, when I was a bankrupt student, I bought a bottle of ESL opium perfume with a brunette girlfriend of mine. And on her, it smelt wonderful. And it made me smell exactly like a cat that had just come back from the vets. And I suddenly understood why.
Do we get a sense of how redheads themselves felt about themselves through history?
You have to sort of read between the lines here. There are moments when red hair was very fashionable. For example, in Elizabethan England, you would have gone so far as to apply oil of vitriol, which is sulfuric acid, on your hair to change its colour to red and to copy the Queen. There are times when you get these little sort of descriptions of redheads. There's a wonderful description of a redheaded villainess in one of Wilkie Collins' novels, Armadale, which is probably one of the most sensational novels he ever wrote. And although he is presenting this woman as being a shocking character, her fascination for him as her creator and her beauty comes across very, very strongly. So I think redheads have probably, particularly redheaded women, have always been aware that their hair colour sets them apart simultaneously in both a bad way and in a good way. It's a very intriguing dichotomy.
Yeah. Heading into the 21st century, what kind of roots can we trace in the way that people are now treated because of their hair colour?
I think you still see many, many times the connection between red hair in women and erotic interest. I think for men, very interestingly, it is now starting to change. There is the possibility that the next James Bond will be Damian Lewis, so we will have a red-headed James Bond. Benedict Cumberbatch, of course, has, you know, sort of people queuing round the block to see him as Hamlet at the moment. Although his hair is darkened for that, he is naturally a redhead. And we have redheads like Ed Sheeran, for example, who have said how the noticeability of red hair was one of the things that kickstarted his career, because it was so easy for people to find his videos on YouTube. They just put in redheaded guy with guitar. So it's something where, as with many, many minority groups, what redheads are doing now, as well as all of the festivals and conventions that we hold, is to take what were the negative stereotypes and turn them into a positive simply by playing up the fact that they are so unusual, which makes them something that people desire. Because, you know, we all want to stand out in some way.
Do we have a figure for how many people in this country at least are redheaded?
Well, globally, the proportion is about 2% of the population of the planet. It goes up and down from one country to another. It's about 10% of the population of Ireland, and it's about 13% of the population of Scotland at the moment. So overall in the UK, it's certainly higher than 2%. I would say it was running at about 5 to 6, but that, you know, is still pretty unusual.
So those links to the Celtic countries, as it were, are kind of valid in a sense.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. It's because they are societies which are, they're liminal, as I describe them in the book. They're a little bit separated geographically from the sort of the genetic ocean of the rest of Europe, as it were. And that, again, has given this recessive genetic recessive gene for red hair a greater opportunity to express itself.
Hmm. What was the biggest challenge for you in writing this book?
Getting my head around some of the genetic material. I was very, very pleased when an anthropologist friend of mine read through it and said, no, what you've said makes sense. And it's a valid explanation for why red hair is so linked with Ireland and Scotland when it began somewhere else altogether. But really, one of the greatest challenges I faced was that there is so many mythologies and so much nonsense on the internet about red hair. And I wanted to make sure that all of the sources I used were authentic, and if they were scientific, that they were peer reviewed, or that they were printed somewhere rather than simply repeated from one website to another.
Apart from Elizabeth, is there a single historical figure or character, I suppose, that's most influenced the way in which we see redheaded people?
There are an awful lot of historical characters who have had red hair ascribed to them. There's a very lively debate as to the possibility of Cleopatra having been a redhead, for example. There is a possibility that Spartacus might have been a redhead. He came from one of those tribes around the Black Sea. Maddeningly, Pliny gives us a very lengthy description of him and doesn't mention his red hair. Let me see, what other redhead characters were there who have really set the... Well, for female redheads, there is Rita Hayworth and Lucille Ball, neither of whom were actually born as redheads, but it's impossible to think of the image of redheaded women today without referring to those two. And the really astonishing thing about them is that they somehow managed to be redheads in black and white, which is a real feat.
That's a good point. I hadn't thought about that. Yeah.
Gilda, it's a black and white movie. How Rita Hayworth manages to be a redhead in that, I do not know, but she certainly does.
And finally, if this book could change people's impressions of redheaded people, how would you like it to do that?
I would like it to make it much clearer and more graspable for redheads and non-redheads alike where the stereotypes that are associated with red hair come from, because that is a fascinating, time-travelling, multicultural detective story. But having done that, I would like it to lead people to question those stereotypes, to understand that really most of them are not worth hanging on to, but at the same time to see it as part of the business of celebrating difference wherever we find it.
That was Jackie Collis Harvey. Red, A Natural History of the Redhead is out now, published by Allen and Unwin in the UK and Black Dog and Leventhal in the US. And that is pretty much it for this week, but please do listen in next time when we'll be talking about the Titanic and the history of railways. Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com, and we might read out your messages in future episodes. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, where you will find history quizzes, galleries, articles, and more. Plus, it's where you can download every single previous episode of this podcast.